Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and I hope you had a very Merry Christmas and you're enjoying the holidays. And if Santa didn't deliver the wax that you were looking for, may you find it on eBay or at your local card shop, whatever the case may be. I wasn't able to find any good wax at the recent card show here in Tampa a couple weeks ago. A little bit of a bummer. You know, normally I go to a local card show and, you know, somebody's got some decent vintage wax just laying around and I can get it at a good price. That wasn't the case. Got a whole lot of cards from the 70s in a bargain bin for like 20 cents a pop. Sure, the corners were slightly rounded and the cards were creased a little bit, but no wax. And that was a little bit of an oddity. And I went on eBay and found this fun little three-pack of unopened wax, all from 1986. One pack of Topps, one pack of Fleer, one pack of Donruss. So we opened those packs on the video link that went out yesterday. If you follow us on Twitter, at Wax and Gum Stains. If you don't follow us on Twitter, please do. But if you don't, you can still go to YouTube. Just type in Wax Ecstatic and you'll see it pop up there. And it was fun opening up these old packs, all from the same year. A very good year for baseball cards, a great year for baseball, which we'll talk about. But didn't get a whole lot in the Topps pack. Got a lot of what I would call C-list stars, you know, semi-star players, if you will. Some decent ball players, but, you know, certainly no big names. The Fleer pack, unfortunately, was a dud. I think Steve Henderson was probably the biggest star card, if you will, in there. But 86 Fleer is such a beautiful set that, you know, you can't be too upset over a pack that didn't have a lot of star power to it. And then the 86 Donruss, we did get some star cards in there, including Don Mattingly. Also, who else did we get in there? Dwight Gooden, Diamond King, and Corey Snyder, rated rookie, a true rated rookie, had no stats on the back of his card. And a Pete Rose, dreaded manager slash player card. So we'll talk a little bit about 1986 and those particular sets later on. We will also talk about the dreaded manager card, which I really ignited a fervent fire with our listeners over the dreaded manager card. And this comes on the heels of the episode about why everybody needed to just calm down and let Harold Baines enjoy his time in Cooperstown. And I thought I had stoked some controversy by saying that Harold Baines deserved to be in the Hall of Fame. Boy, I ain't seen nothing yet with my thoughts about the dreaded manager card. I'll give you a little history as to why I could care less about the manager card in most cases. And that's a key. I don't think that comes through a lot in our conversations on Twitter. But in most cases, I could care less about the dreaded manager card. But we'll touch up on that. Also, an interesting set that one of our listeners brought up in just a little bit. We got a whole lot going on here, so we'll get to that in a moment after we do our traditional housekeeping. Just a reminder that Wax Ecstatic during the off season is coming your way every other Friday. So our next show will be in 2019, January 11th, 2019. And hopefully by then I'll be able to track down some good wax that we can open up and share. If not, I'll find something to talk about. And of course, we always welcome your suggestions. The best way to do that is via Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Send any comments, suggestions, questions that you have, and we can certainly address that. So look for that show to come your way on January 11th. In the meantime, if you like the program and you would like to support it financially, you can do so by making a cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you've already made a donation, thank you so much for doing so. And if you haven't made a donation, you're more than welcome to, even if it's just a few dollars, and we've received a couple of donations over the past few weeks. We thank you for doing so. And just a reminder that the donations that you do send go right back into the show. The money does not just sit in my pocket, doesn't go feed my kids. No, it goes right back into the show. One, maintaining our home base at audioboom.com. And with that, the archives, over 100 shows that we've done over the past few years, are up there. And they get fed to all of our other various platforms, including iTunes and iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify, and all the other networks that get the RSS feed out there. And also, the money goes to the purchase of these packs. And I do have my eyes on a few deals on eBay right now. The next show that I go to won't be until, I think, 4 weeks from now, so it won't be in time for the next show, but hopefully we can find some gems at the next card show that I can go to that we can bring on to a later podcast as we commence into January. So again, paypal.me/waxecstatic if you wish to make a cash donation. And while cash is king, I always appreciate your word of mouth. Tell your friends, tell your fellow collectors, tell everybody about Wax Ecstatic. Remind them that we do come at your way during the off season every other Friday. And we also have the Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And that's a great way to keep up to date on not only what's happening with Wax Ecstatic, but also just to talk within the community. And we've got some very lively discussions going on there. Boy, the outcry really came from the last podcast when I derided all of the manager cards that came in the 1985 Top Cello. Now, I've called them the stinking manager cards for many years. And let me explain why the stinking, dreaded manager cards, why that is what they are. This goes all the way back to episode number 3 of our podcast. So this is about 2.5 years ago. Episode number 3, 1981 Donruss. The random card that I pull from my big box full of 81 Donruss, Red Shaendienst. Now, nothing against Red Shaendienst. May he rest in peace. We lost him this past year. But Red Shaendienst, outstanding player, outstanding representative for baseball, outstanding representative for like 96% of his career, playing, coaching, management, all with the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, there was no more Red Bird than Red Shaendienst. No doubt about it. But when we're talking about a particular set and I'm doing a random pull and I wanted to tell the story of a particular card or a particular player, you get the manager card and it's just like, you know. Now, again, it's nothing against Red Shaendienst in this case, but I'd rather have the player card than talking about the manager. So I went on this little diatribe during episode 3 about how I would much rather have a plain old checklist card or a team leader's card than the manager card. And one of the big reasons why is because I'm not collecting for the manager. I'm collecting for the players. And in a lot of cases, if you're opening up a pack of cards, a new pack of cards in, say, June or July, if you pull the manager card from a crappy team, chances are he's been fired already. So, you know, it's just like, well, this is just kind of a wasted placeholder in my set box here. And that outrages a lot of people. And there was an argument that was made after episode 3 about manager cards of Hall of Fame players. So, for example, Ted Williams. People would say, well, I would pick up a Ted Williams manager card when he was with Washington or later Texas, and that was the only way I could afford a Ted Williams card. Same thing with Leo Durocher, Billy Martin. I get it. And, you know, you look at some of the manager cards, like, you know, there was Chuck Tanner and Tony La Russa in the last pack, and you go, hey, they were pretty good Hall of Fame managers here, and you're absolutely right. But my point was, you know, I got in this pack of, what was it, 28 cards, 5 of them were manager or coach cards. It's just like, come on. That's just, you know, the proportion of manager cards in that pack was just ridiculous. So, you know, I kind of vented, just like, yeah, to be kidding me, I got 5 of these things. But going back to the Hall of Fame player turned manager, over time, I've accepted this and I've actually taken part in it. In fact, once while rummaging through a stack of mid-70s Topps cards at a local card shop, I saw a Billy Martin card when he was with the Texas Rangers. And I set that aside. I bought that with this lot of mid-70s cards that I was buying simply because I had reread Seasons in Hell, which is about the 1973 through 75 Texas Rangers, in which Billy Martin was a big part of that. But I had also read Billy Martin's autobiography number 1 not too long before then. So I had had this wealth of knowledge of Billy Martin, and it's just like, oh, there's a Billy Martin card. So I picked up the 74 Topps Billy Martin card, and if you recall, the 74 Topps, and they did this in 73 as well. The manager card also had little floating heads of his coaching staffs, which was kind of neat. But, you know, that's a good example there. Also, Gil Hodges. You know, my dad, big Brooklyn Dodgers fan, lived in New York when the Mets won the World Series in 1969. Well, Gil Hodges was a big part of both of those teams. So I have a Gil Hodges Washington Senators card, I think 67. He was the manager there. And then I've got 2 cards of Gil Hodges, 1971, 1972. Of course, he died in 72. So there are some instances where I'll pick up an old manager card because they were either a really great manager at the time, or, as some listeners have pointed out, you can't afford their player card, certainly in mint condition. So if you want that Leo DeRocher or Ted Williams or Gil Hodges card, you have to, you know, get the manager card because you don't want to shell out a couple $100 for his player card. Totally get that. Totally understand that. And that is, again, something that I've warmed up to over the years, that's okay. But again, in this particular case of this particular pack of 85 Topps, the cello pack with 28 cards, 5 of them are manager cards. I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Not all of these. And that certainly sparked a lot of people getting upset here, including our buddy Steve, Wax Pack 916, a Hall of Fame manager card, no less. I'm in the minority. I like manager cards. Bring them back. Cards to Trade Dave says, I love the manager cards with the team checklist on the back. In the days before the internet, how else was I to know which player were part of each team? True to a case there, Dave, where you do mention that pre-internet, that was a way to collate your team cards all together. But that's why I said I actually like the team leader cards. At least you got like an action shot of something going on. And you normally had a checklist. Sometimes, though, you had the team stats from the year before, and that wasn't quite as useful there. All-time greats.blog writes, I wouldn't mind them either, at least in the flagship products. Managers are an important part of the team. Yes, managers are an important part of the team, but again, it's not what I'm looking for. And hey, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just me, and it's no disrespect to managers. Maybe I'm just like, you know, I'd rather have a player card, but I've just never been big on the manager card. I just haven't. So I understand why you may want him back in there, but if you have a base set, and let's say the size of the base set is, I don't know, 600 cards. So of 600 cards, do you really want 30 of them to be dedicated to the manager? And of those 30, there's a chance that at the end of the season, when the complete factory set is out for your purchase, 10 of these guys aren't even employed anymore. Meh. No, not really. I would rather have those 30 cards either used for, you know, other base players, certainly rookies, perhaps all-star cards. We had somebody in our mentions say, bring back the dedicated all-star cards. I'm fine with that. Or, here's an idea. What if you took the manager card, and instead of just having the picture of the manager sitting in the dugout or standing on the field, as the case may be, if it's a former player, why not include a picture of him when he played? Kind of a then and now. You know, it'd be kind of neat if you have, two pictures. You know, Joe Maddon, you know, here he is as the minor league ball player in the late 70s, and here he is with the Chicago Cubs. So I'll throw this suggestion out again. If you have to have the manager card in there, make it an interesting twist. Show me a picture of the manager when he was playing, and it could be minor league pictures. It could be little league pictures. I mean, it could be something fun like that, as opposed to just guy with a big mouthful of chaw in his jaw, and he's just standing there at the batting cage. You know, it's just not all that interesting, in my opinion. So if you have any opinions, you can share them on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and keep the conversation going there. Now, an interesting question, which will lead into our opening up of packs from 1986. A great couple of points here from John Cronin. John says, hi, love the podcast, devout listener. Just wondering if you have ever discussed the 1975 SSP set, which is my all-time favorite set. Well, John, thanks for joining us, just following us on Twitter a few weeks ago, and for jumping into the conversation. I did promise that I would briefly talk about this set in this episode here. And it's an interesting set, 1975, and it's kind of a 75-76 set, technically, because it was produced in the fall and winter of 1975. For those who don't know, the SSPC set, SSPC stands for Sports Stars Publishing Company. Now, this is a product of, another bit of alphabet soup here, TCMA. Now, TCMA, if you've been a collector for a long time, you recognize those letters. TCMA stands for Tom Collier and Mike Ehrenstein. That would be the first and second initial of their names. Also, TCMA stands for the Card Memorabilia Associates. That's kind of the business name, if you will. So, Card Memorabilia Associates, or TCMA, if you've been a longtime listener of this podcast and you've listened to the podcast on minor league sets, which we did a couple years ago, then you would know that TCMA was really the foundation of the minor league baseball card sets starting in the mid-1970s. There really was no minor league baseball card until then. And once TCMA started producing these cards in the mid to late 70s, eventually by the mid-80s, you had pro cards come around. And then minor league cards got to be a very big deal in the early 90s, not just with pro cards, but also Upper Deck got into the act, all together creating these minor league cards, which a lot of collectors saw as the pre-rookie cards, if you will. Well, TCMA also ventured into major league cards in 1975. As I mentioned, in the fall of 1975, you had, again, Collier and Ehrenstein had a magazine that was called Collectors Quarterly, or it was also known as CQ, kind of like GQ, Gentlemen's Quarterly. So you had Collectors Quarterly, and they decided that they were going to produce a 630 card set for SSPC and Collectors Quarterly. So they were going to debut the set through the winter edition, 75 going into 76, of Collectors Quarterly. And basically, a panel of cards would be included in the magazine. You would pull the panel out, and then if you wanted to, you could very carefully cut the cards up and hand them out, trade them, sell them, whatever the case may be. And the big thought going into this set was, well, this kind of teaser set would act almost as a traded set. Now, this is very innovative. This is before Topps had traded set in the 1976 base set. So when you had players traded, when you had players who retired, or if you had, speaking of dreaded manager cards, if you had managers hired or fired somewhere, you could basically use these cards as kind of a bridge between the 1975 and 1976 top sets. Very forward thinking, but the design was very retro thinking. I don't want to say backwards thinking, because that was also forward thinking. You know, nowadays, what is old is new again. Everyone's in the retro craze. Everybody's been in a retro craze in sports for the last, I'd say, 15 or 20 years now. And think of this. In 1975, you had the very loud, colorful, I'm not saying bad, but very colorful two-tone Topps baseball cards. Well, if you were a traditionalist collector back then, you didn't want all of this loud color jumping out at you. And in fact, Topps kind of had loud colors, especially the 72 set. 74 set was a little more muted, but a very colorful, one of my favorite sets, actually. And you had some traditionalists going, you know, this isn't baseball cards. This is comic book stuff. This is, you know, sugary cereal stuff for the kids. What is this? We want our basic baseball cards back. So the guys at TCMA /SSPC/CQ were inspired by the 1953 Bowman set, which, if you've ever seen the 53 Bowman cards, beautiful cards, basically all picture and stats on the back, or not just stats, you had some narrative as well. And that was their inspiration. So they created a set designed essentially like the 53 Bowman set. Now, one drawback to this is that, you know, this is a small company doing this. They had to rely on freelance photographers, including one Keith Olbermann, who would also write a lot of the text on the back of these cards. I've also mentioned Olbermann, I think it was like 14 or 15 of his fan photos were part of the 81 Donruss set. So he was a big baseball fan living and growing up in New York at the time. Well, they had to count on people like Keith Olbermann and other freelance photographers to provide the pictures. And because this was not an officially licensed product, these photographers didn't necessarily have a media pass to go down on the field and take these professional photos. This was just hobbyist pictures, often taken from the stands, leaning over the dugout, often taken during pregame warmups. So the guys, the players are relaxed, they're goofing off a little bit. You know, it wasn't your typical baseball card picture. And certainly not just the style of the picture, but the quality of the picture. You know, a lot of these photographers not only didn't have the equipment that the Topps photographers had, but they certainly didn't have the dark room and the post-production process to spruce up the pictures like Topps did. So what you had was, in heart and in spirit, a 53 Bowman card, but in photography quality, often, not always, but often, kind of an 81 Donruss look, and maybe an 84 Fleer style to it. You know, you didn't have Glenn Hubbard with a snake around his shoulders, but you catch the drift. You saw a lot of pictures of ball players just kind of goofing off and letting their guard down, which is kind of neat. Well, SSPC starts putting these cards out here, and they had 18 cards in the winter of 1975. People are starting to cut them up. People are starting to trade them. There's value that's coming to them. And what do you know? Topps catches wind of this and says, no. So while SSPC got cards out there, SSPC was sued by Topps, and there was a settlement. And part of the settlement with Ehrenstein was that he was not to disclose any of the information about the settlement. He was no longer allowed to sell the cards, and he had to dispose of the inventory on hand. And that's the key there, on hand. So there was already, you know, several hundred, if not thousands of cards already out in the market. Also, Arenstein agreed that he could not reprint the set. So basically, Topps just puts the hammer down here, and that's that. Now, the SSPC set is an interesting set because if you didn't like the loud colors of 75 or a lot of the sets from the mid-70s from Topps, this was a very nice, basic, and well-produced, you know, the photography wasn't best, the design was very minimalistic, but it was as best as could possibly be. It was a pretty professional set that was put out there, and it at least made collectors think for a moment, hey, maybe there is life outside of Topps. You know, remember, in 1975, going into 76, the baseball card hobby had gone 20 years of just being Topps, and Topps squashing out the competition, not just SSPC, but also Fleer in the early 60s, and anybody else who even dared to encroach on their territory, their monopoly. But the cards are unique, and I actually, it's funny when you mentioned that particular set, John. When I went to that card show a couple weeks ago looking for some wax for the show, I went through a bin of old 50% off cards, and I actually found an SSPC card. Now, I did not buy it. For two reasons. One, I'm on a limited budget when I go to these shows, and that is on purpose because it is very easy to go into this small little show that's got a lot of great cards and some really friendly dealers, and you can easily blow a couple hundred dollars here. Easily. So I go in with, all right, I'm going to spend $20. And if you've ever tried to just spend $20 at a card show, it is very difficult. So I try to go in with $20. Often I end up spending, you know, maybe up to $25. But I'm pretty proud of myself that, okay, I'm in that $20 to $25 window as opposed to, well, geez, you know, there goes $86 or whatever. So I didn't buy it for that reason. I do have a hunch, because it is kind of a no-frills card, that it will still be in the bin when I go back there next month. The other reason why, and it was a Willie Mays card, by the way, Willie Mays ending his career with the Mets at this point in time. What lacks for that set in terms of design and picture quality, that is best shown in this Willie Mays card. So go ahead, Google the image, 1975 SSPC Willie Mays. And you'll see it's just kind of this awkward shot of, you know, Mays kind of craning his neck out of the dugout. You know, the picture is clearly taken by somebody who's kind of leaning over the dugout or next to the dugout. The color needs to be corrected. You know, it's very nitpicky stuff here, I know. But I didn't buy it at the time simply for those reasons. Now, like I said, when the next show comes around, because I know it is only a few dollars and you know, there were other cards that I wanted to get my hands on, if that card is still there, I will pick it up because it is a rather unique card, even though it does have its quality limitations. But it's unique in that SSPC tried to challenge the big guys at Topps. This is very much a David versus Goliath situation here. And while I know there are some recollections of this particular card set that says SSPC inspired Fleer, I believe it's actually kind of the other way around, because everything I've read about Fleer's challenge to Topps, which eventually led to Fleer and Donruss getting into the game in 1981, that actually started in 1974, going into the 1975 baseball season and set production. So I don't necessarily think that SSPC inspired Fleer. I don't think Fleer inspired SSPC. What I do think, though, is that these two actions, hand in hand, were able to eventually get the ball rolling on a court decision that would take 5 years to come out. You know, came out in the summer of 1980 that Topps did have a monopoly and they had to open it up to competition. But I do think that SSPC, no matter what you think about the particular set, certainly helped set the tone of what would become an open market of baseball cards, turning the hobby into an industry, and for good or bad, became what it did, especially in the 90s when it got too big. And it is what it is today. There is still, ironically, I wouldn't say healthy competition, because a lot of the brands today fall under the Topps umbrella. So it's rather funny that you've got basically the Topps company running the officially licensed baseball card products, but they just have all the different brands now. So remember why I said what is old and is new again. You know, the monopoly of Topps in the 60s and 70s has kind of come back around over the last few years. And as we mentioned in an earlier podcast this summer, while a lot of people wish that Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association would open up more licenses for more companies to make officially licensed products so that the hobby can kind of have more than just Topps and its various brands, I don't think it's going to happen, because that agreement between Topps and the Players Association and Major League Baseball, which granted Topps exclusivity to the officially licensed products back in 2010, was just recently extended for several more years, I think through 2023. So on the whole, that's going to be 14 inclusive seasons of this deal. So while collectors, some may want it that way, clearly it's working for the system. It's working for the people who make the money. That, of course, being Major League Baseball, the Players Association, and the Topps Company. That's who's really benefiting from it. So don't expect any changes anytime soon. Great question. Great point there, John. I wish you luck in collecting your 1975-76 SSPC cards. And as I said, I will actually keep my eye out for a few of those cards, see if I can get some bargains, because even though I'm not a huge fan of the particular design or the photography quality, at least in some of the cards that I've seen, I will say it is a very unique set from a crucial point in the hobby. And let's also give credit to the TCMA guys, not only being the David versus Goliath, being part of the formation of the competition in the baseball card hobby over the mid to late 70s that opened the doors in the early 80s. But as I mentioned too, being the foundation of the minor league baseball card, which still, while it's certainly not as overindulgent as it was in the early 90s, minor league baseball cards still have an audience and still have a premium for people who like to speculate which prospects are actually going to make it. Bowman has really gone deep into the minor leagues, even though it is a Major League Baseball card set and there are major league players. As anybody knows who's collected Bowman over the last several years, a lot of these prospects are guys you don't see in the big leagues for 3, 4, 5 years now. So it's a really speculative brand. But it does pay off if you get that one gem who does, you know, make it to the show and have a very productive career. But also, I've seen Topps Heritage releasing minor league cards as well in the design of the base set. So there's still an audience for minor league baseball cards, and it comes more than 40 years after TCMA started producing some of the minor league sets. All right, let's talk about some major league sets. Even though I passed on the Willie Mays card, and even though I didn't find the wax at the most recent show I went to, I found a very interesting lot that was available on eBay, a pack each of 86 Topps, 86 Fleer, and 86 Donruss. And I got it at a good price. I would have gotten it at a better price had I remembered to apply the coupon code. eBay had just a couple weeks ago one of those 15% off days. You know, you type in this code and you get that off the top. And basically, had I done that, I would have paid like, with shipping, it would have been like $3 a pack. That's a little too much for the 86 Topps, but for the others, it's kind of right in the marketplace value for those packs. But Anyways, all right, so I ended up paying the extra $1.50 because I was too lazy and or stupid to remember the code at the end of the shopping process. But it was a lot of fun opening up these packs here. The 86 Tops didn't get anything too great. You know, some of these C-list stars like I was talking about, you know, Rance Mullenix, Hubie Brooks, who was part of the Gary Carter trade in 1985, Lonnie Smith, another one. Couple other players that we'll bring up in just a little bit. The 86 Fleer pack didn't get anything. Like I said, Steve Henderson is really the biggest name there, but nothing to get really excited about in that pack. But 86 Fleer is such a great set that even when you get a dud pack, you still like looking at them. The dark blue borders, the full color logos, the photography was getting a lot better. Not a lot of action shots, a lot of stage shots. But and then 86 Donruss, the factory set that I called the Max Headroom set, has a very 1986 look to it. It's great. It's awesome. And 86 Donruss you can get for a pretty good price right now. The big card in that set, still Jose Canseco. And even though it doesn't fetch the money that a Canseco rookie card would have 25, 30 years ago, still you can get it, especially if you get it in PSA 10 condition, you know, you could still get a $50, $60 for it. But you had, some early career cards for Kirby Puckett and Roger Clemens. And, we pulled Jimmy Key out of this pack, Don Mattingly out of this pack as well. You also had Bonds and Gwynn and Sandberg and Ripken and Henderson and all the big names from the 1980s. So while the 86 sets, Fleer and Donruss had Canseco, Topps missed, but Topps would make good for it with a Canseco and Barry Bonds in the traded set later on in the year. Even though beyond Canseco and, say, Andrés Galarraga, there weren't massive big-name rookie cards, 86 sets are pretty good, pretty affordable, good designs, pretty popular, and they're kind of on a cutoff line between affordable and starting to get out of your affordability range if you're looking for cards in the 1980s. And of course, in 1986, this was kind of the beginning of the junk wax era because the hobby had grown so much in the early to mid 80s. You not only had three companies, but you had Sports Flicks happening then. You're just a few years away from Score coming around, and then Upper Deck and Bowman, and the hobby just exploding with all the sets that were out there. So the production was increased for Topps and Fleer and Donruss starting in 86 and 87, not quite to like 1990 or 91, statistics where there's literally 5 or 6 million of each individual card printed. But the production started growing just a little bit in 86 and 87, and then it started, kind of spiraling out of control in 88, 89, and beyond. But you can still get wax packs, you can get wax boxes, you can get vending boxes for 1986 sets at a pretty affordable cost. A little more than what you'll have to pay for, 88 or 89 or 90. But for a few dollars more, you can still get some vintage cards at a very good price and a very good value. And again, because really only the Canseco card is the only big dollar card from the sets those years, you have a lot of value in those second and third and fourth year cards for some of the stars from the 1980s. So you'll definitely want to check those out if you're looking for a nice affordable set to perhaps build up or just to add to your mid-80s collection. Any of the sets from 1986 are good values to get. 86, of course, a very memorable year in baseball. You had the Mets, the Miracle Mets of 1986. I don't have to tell you about, the 86 World Series. I mean, it's rehashed every year. The 86 Mets are just such an interesting team. And it's not like things that happened with the 86 Mets only happened with the 86 Mets. There was drug use on other teams. There were players sleeping around with other players' wives on other teams. There were players who had great careers but then fell into drug and alcohol abuse and run-ins with the law. That's happened with other teams. But there's just something about the 86 Mets that resonates with baseball fans, even if you're not a Mets fan. But there's just something about that team where it's just amazing that they did what they did because they were such a dysfunctional family. That's the nicest way I can put it. But there have been so many books written about the 86 Mets, some of them by the players on the 86 Mets. So many documentaries done about the 86 Mets, so many stories about the 86 Mets. It's just amazing how that storyline continues. Now, part of it, of course, is it's New York City. So you're just going to get this added boost of coverage and memorabilia and talks about the 86 Mets. Of course, the way that that World Series played out, the rain delays early on in the series, that incredible Game 6 where the Mets were literally down to their final strike, their final pitch, and of course the Mookie Wilson hit between the legs of Bill Buckner. We all remember that. A lot of people conveniently forget that the Mets didn't win the World Series that game. They actually won it in Game 7, and oh, by the way, the Red Sox were winning in that game. You know, all those years that Red Sox fans just hammered Bill Buckner, they forget, hey, you guys had a chance to win in Game 7, oh, by the way. So, you know, it's just so funny how that World Series played out. You know, it's also 1986 was a big, I mean, the conservative political engine, the economy's booming, Team America. I mean, you know, I've often said that 1984 was kind of the, you know, born in the USA year in the 1980s, you know, America kind of turned the corner and started this giant leap forward into, you know, the country that a lot of us grew up in and recognize as America, you know, starting in the Reagan years up until now. And 1986 really epitomized like the wheelhouse year of that rise up to what America became in the 80s. And that's because, you know, again, the economy is booming. You know, cable television is out there. There's some big movies that are out there, some big songs that are out there. The Soviet Union is starting to crumble. The Berlin Wall, you know, things are starting to get shaky in Eastern Europe. And on top of that, like I recall as a kid, you know, that was the centennial of the Statue of Liberty. So for two or three years, the Statue of Liberty was in the scaffolding as they were refurbishing it, and they replaced the torch with this new gold flame on it. And I just, you know, think that looking back at it, 1986 was, now it wasn't all good. You know, you had the Challenger disaster in 1986. You had the crack cocaine epidemic going on at full speed. AIDS, you know, a lot of people were just so fearful of HIV and AIDS. You know, there were a lot of, and you know, nuclear war. I mean, we were going to go to war with the Russians any minute now. So, you know, there was a lot of anxiety in 1986 as well. But kind of looking back at the year, the politics, the music, the television, the movies, some of the gaffes from 1986, you know, I mentioned in the tweet setting up this show, 1986, the year of New Coke, which is still the benchmark for public relations and marketing disasters prior to the Trump administration. But still, from a commercial standpoint, that is the that's still the gold standard, if you will, of what not to do with your product or service. But also, you know, I mentioned Flight of the Navigator. Remember that movie? I actually watched it recently. I recorded it on my DVR a couple months ago, finally got around to watching it. I actually had my son watch it with me. And yeah, it's a little campy. It was a Disney movie. And it's kind of a time capsule in and of itself from 1986. But it's such a fun movie. I still enjoyed watching it, even though it is kind of a campy 80s movie. And it has a storyline that a lot of other 80s movies had, you know, some kind of cyborg thing, kid, alien from the future, you know, whatever. You know, it was such a fun movie. So you had a lot of pop culture coming into 1986, and it kind of played into that. The baseball season, kind of the lore of the Mets that year as well. And I think the fact that with the triumph of the 86 Mets, I think one reason why a lot of people remember the triumph so vividly is the tragedy that comes with it. Like I said, they were a dysfunctional family, to put it nicely, then. But now, you know, you see what's happened to Dwight Gooden. You know about Daryl Strawberry, the ups and downs that he's gone through. Gary Carter passing away from cancer a few years ago. You know, you can't have a full reunion of the 86 Mets because, you know, some have died, some are on the run, and then some have managed to keep it all together. We mentioned Ron Darling in our last podcast, Keith Hernandez as well. There's a lot of other players who have done just fine since playing for the 86 Mets, but it's just so funny how the 86 Mets, even though that was only the second World Series championship won by the Mets in their history, even though that was only the third of four World Series appearances by the Mets in their franchise history, even though they have not won a World Series since. And I stand corrected. That was the third of their fifth World Series appearance. I forgot about 2015 against Kansas City. But even though that's the only World Series or the last World Series victory, and now you're going on 33 years and counting, there's just something about the 1986 baseball season all summed up in that very high energy, high octane, wild and crazy World Series. And you've had wild and crazy World Series since then, but just something about the 86 Mets. And I'll throw this out there too. I think one reason why people remember that World Series so fondly too is because of the Mets uniforms, that classic pinstripe uniform with the Mets script and the blue and orange stripes going down the shoulders and the arms. I'm not a Mets fan, but even I have one of those jerseys. It's a beauty of a jersey. It's so ridiculously simple. It's outstanding. I love it. So I think that's part of it too. But 1986, a fun year, not just in sports, not just in baseball, but certainly in America. And like I said, there were a lot of anxieties. You know, let's not pretend that everything was peaches and cream back then. But I recall 1986 in my life, in my recollection, to be a very overall positive year in America. And like I said, it kind of plays off of that boost that the nation got in 1984 and would have for several more years. Now, real quickly, some of the cards that we pulled from the packs, I want to share some of the stories. I've got six players here, and one of them is Willie Upshaw, who we pulled from the 86 Topps pack. Willie Upshaw would eventually get replaced at first base in Toronto by my good buddy Fred McGriff. And unfortunately, Willie Upshaw kind of gets lost in the cloud of history in that he was such a dominant first baseman and an outstanding power hitter. But because his career was kind of short, in fact, he only played 11 seasons in the major leagues, only, you kind of get lost, with the idea of some big leaguers playing 18, 19, 20 years. He played 11 seasons, but because he played in Toronto for most of them and Cleveland in his last year with a rather bad Indians team, you forget about him. But here's a guy who was a career 262 hitter, had 123 home runs, but 528 RBI. He was the first Blue Jays player to reach the 100 RBI plateau in a season. Did you know that? He had 104 RBI in 1983, batted 306 as well. Now, McGriff comes up through the pipeline, replaces him. He signs with the Cleveland Indians, only plays 1 year there, plays a couple seasons in Japan, and then he would start his coaching career. He was a manager of the Bridgeport Bluefish in the late 90s and in 2000, came back to the major leagues as the first base coach with the San Francisco Giants. In fact, when Barry Bonds hit home run number 756, it was Willie Upshaw who gives him the first high five as Bonds is going around the bases. Upshaw would go back to Bridgeport several years ago as a manager for the Bridgeport Bluefish once again. And the Upshaw name should sound familiar to anybody in sports, especially football, as Willie Upshaw is the cousin of the late Gene Upshaw, former Hall of Fame guard with the Oakland Raiders, of course, a representative for the NFLPA for many years. Also a cousin of former defensive lineman Marvin Upshaw, and his son, Chad Upshaw, was part of the Carolina Panthers organization for a few years, a tight end who was an undrafted free agent who starred at the University of Buffalo. Now, Jim Gantner, when I opened up the pack, we got this out of the 86 Tops pack, I said, you know, we had this discussion several shows ago about, was Rance Mullenix the Ben Zobrist of his time, or is Ben Zobrist the Rance Mullenix of his time? And there's an argument to be made for that. I said, I think Jim Gantner is kind of in that same boat, and he kind of is. Gantner was more of a second baseman early in his career, became a utility guy, you know, by 1986, basically the last six, seven, 8 years of his career, played second, a little bit of third base, DH'd every now and then. But what's interesting about Jim Gantner is when you look back at those Milwaukee Brewers teams from the 70s and 80s, and you think of, first and foremost, Robin Yount and Paul Molitor, and then you also think of guys like Cecil Cooper and Gorman Thomas and Ted Simmons and, you know, Raleigh Fingers and Pete Vukovic. You know, you think of all those Milwaukee Brewers. You often overlook Jim Gantner, and you shouldn't. A career 274 hitter, played his entire career, 17-year career, with the Milwaukee Brewers. He was there when Yount was starting. He was there before Molitor. And his final season, 1992, was also Molitor's last season. Molitor would sign as a free agent with Toronto in 93, and that was 1 year before Yount retired. And here's another interesting factoid that involves Hank Aaron. I told you about Willie Upshaw and Barry Bonds when Bonds surpassed Aaron with a 756th home run. When Hank Aaron played his last game for the Milwaukee Brewers, October 3rd, 1976, who was the pinch runner for Hank Aaron? None other than James Elmer Gantner. Another James. This would be James Edward Key, Jimmy Key, native of Huntsville, Alabama, another often overlooked pitcher. Didn't quite get the headlines that a Dave Steeb did with Toronto back in the days, but a key part to the growth and eventual championship team that the Blue Jays had. He was a star pitcher for Clemson in the early 1980s, pitched the opening game of the 1980 College World Series, drafted in the third round of the 1982 draft by the Blue Jays, very quickly moves up the pipeline, makes his debut in April of 1984, and would also be the key southpaw in the rotation. Wins a World Series with the Blue Jays in 1992, although he was a pending free agent. Was a guy who was leaving the mound, I think it was game four, pitched 7 2/3 innings, tremendous ovation by the Sky Dome crowd. He would be a reliever in the deciding game six. In fact, was the winning pitcher in game six, Dave Winfield providing the game-winning hit. Of course, Otis Nixon grounding out to Joe Carter at first base. But yeah, Jimmy Key was the game-winning pitcher in the 92 World Series, leaves Toronto, and the Blue Jays were okay with that because they had some young guys coming up through the system, including Juan Guzman. You had Pat Henkin coming up. David Wells was going to be the lefty of the future. Of course, he didn't quite work out in Toronto. You had Todd Stottlemyre then. But anyways, he signs as a free agent with the New York Yankees, has some of his best years there, but the Yankees still kind of turning into the team that they would become. Not quite a good team, though, so he gets overlooked there. But wins another World Series in 1996. In fact, was the starter for the series deciding Game 6 at Yankee Stadium. In fact, he went up against Greg Maddux and outdueled him there. After 1996, it's deja vu all over again. Wins a World Series, but walks as a free agent. Signs a two-year deal with the Baltimore Orioles and would finish his career there. Now, he is apparently an avid golfer, an amateur now living out in Palm Beach Gardens, a big star there in the golfing community. We pulled this from the 86 Donruss pack, Rafi Ramirez. I chuckle when I see a Rafi Ramirez card, because Rafi Ramirez, or Rafael Ramirez, I should say, is often, if New Coke is the benchmark of what not to do in a public relations disaster, Rafael Ramirez is often the poster child of this guy shouldn't be in the All-Star game. Even though he was hitting 304 as a shortstop with the Atlanta Braves in 1984 at the All-Star break, the fact that Rafael Ramirez was an All-Star really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Even though he had a pretty productive career, it was not a very, flair-filled career, if you will. Managed to play 8 seasons with the Braves. Devastating knee injury in 1988 would sideline him. He eventually signed with the Houston Astros and was able to revive his career, but with a very bad Astros team in the late 80s and early 90s, often overlooked. But still, pretty decent player, .261 career batting average, .484 RBI, and again, an All-Star in 1984 with the Braves. Harold Reynolds, 2-time All-Star, 87 and 88 with the Seattle Mariners. We pulled this card from the 86 Donruss set, or the pack, I should say. He was selected second overall in the first round of the secondary phase of the amateur draft in 1980, and was a star out of Corvallis, Oregon. He was a star at Corvallis High School in football, basketball, and baseball. And he would not only become an All-Star in Seattle, but a 3-time Gold Glove winner, the stolen base leader for the American League in 1987. But a lot of people didn't know, because the Mariners were just so bad that nobody really cared outside of Seattle. Or heck, some people would say even in Seattle, nobody really cared about the Mariners, as they had to deal with their numerous off and on the field problems. Now, he would play for the Mariners through 1992, a very, very productive career. And because the Mariners were not good, and being in Seattle at the time, you know, this is pre grunge music, Starbucks living, Fraser Crane talk radio life, Seattle that we know and love now. You know, Seattle was very much off the radar in the national scene of things. So it wasn't really until he goes to Baltimore as a free agent that people are kind of paying attention to him. Only plays 1 year in Baltimore, later 1 year with the Angels. In fact, he was traded to the Angels in March of 1994 for Hilly Hathaway, a great early 90s baseball name. Hello. Yes, this is Hilly Hathaway of the California Angels. How are you today? That's how I'd imagine a Hilly Hathaway. Yes, it's Hilly Hathaway. I am calling you from Willoughby. It is 1883. So Harold Reynolds doesn't really get a lot of attention, or at least enough that he really deserved. I mean, he got lots of hardware, but people really don't think of Harold Reynolds as being a quality ball player, as he was throughout the 80s and early 90s in Seattle. Well, he becomes a broadcaster as part of the Baseball Tonight studio set in 1996 through 2006. Fired in 2006 for a sexual harassment issue, he sues ESPN, and ESPN settled the case in April of 2008. Reynolds received a 7-figure settlement. So that tells you that somehow he was found to be in the right, likely, and he was able to find a pretty good career afterwards, doing broadcasting with TBS for a few years, MLB.com, and he's been part of the MLB Network crew since 2009. And finally, Corey Snyder. The rated rookie, and this was actually one of the rated rookies who actually did have a good career, although injuries would rob Corey Snyder of a very productive career. Star player for the Cleveland Indians in the late 1980s, also before that, part of the 1984 men's Olympic baseball team, better known for Mark McGwire, but Corey Snyder was part of that silver medal team in the Los Angeles Olympics. He would go on to play in the big leagues in 1986, after starring at BYU and with that Olympic team, would come right out of the gate with a phenomenal rookie year in 1986. In fact, finished fourth in the American League Rookie of the Year voting. And I recall going into the 1987 season, because Snyder had a good year, Joe Carter had a good year, and the Indians were actually somewhat respectable in 1986. There's the infamous 1987 Sports Illustrated cover, something like, the tribe is rising, and you had Corey Snyder and Joe Carter, and of course, that didn't work. The SI curse came back as the Indians went back to losing 97 games or whatever they did in 1987. While the Indians weren't able to maintain expectations, Corey Snyder did, until he got injured while playing with the Chicago White Sox in 1991, would bounce around and play one incomplete season after another, from Chicago to Toronto to San Francisco, had a couple productive years with the Dodgers in 93 and 94, but after that, he was done. Now, Corey Snyder will always remain in my heart, not just because he had the awesome hockey hair. Corey Snyder will always be part of my personal life in that in the spring of 1991, I was a bat boy for a spring training game for the Toronto Blue Jays, and I was pulled out of a crowd. I'm the bat boy for the game. The Blue Jays are hosting the Chicago White Sox. Corey Snyder is on deck. Now, keep in mind here, in 1991, I'm 13 years old. I'm wearing my favorite team's uniform. I'm their bat boy. Now, I'm not in their dugout. I'm stationed over at the White Sox dugout. I have no idea what I'm doing. None. I can't put the bats right back in the right place. I'm kind of in la-la land. There's a long story that I'll post a link to on Wax and Gum Stains to kind of give a little more background to the story. But the one part that involves Corey Snyder is Corey Snyder almost killed me because Corey Snyder's on deck. And one of my duties as a bat boy was I had this canvas bag full of baseballs next to me. And every time the umpire looked over at me, he would hold up certain number of fingers, three or four typically. And I would grab that many baseballs out of the bag and run over to the umpire and hand it to him. And he'd put them in his little ball holder. So I'm sitting on this little stool next to the White Sox dugout. And the umpire looks over me and I think he holds up four fingers. So I grab four baseballs. And just in my delirium, I just pick them up and just start running to the umpire. Well, I'm running, and without even thinking to where I'm at, I've run right past the on-deck circle where Corey Snyder, big, muscular Corey Snyder, is swinging his bat. Now, Corey Snyder was 6'4", 175 pounds. He was not a lanky 6'4", 175. He was a built dude. And if you looked at some of the home runs he hit, he could clobber the ball. And he nearly clobbered my head as I run past Corey Snyder with these baseballs for the umpire. Snyder takes a cut in the on-deck circle. And I hear in my ear hole, because I had the batting helmet on, I hear in my ear hole this whoosh. And then I hear a few thousand people in the Dunedin Blue Jay ballpark go, ooh. And I remember seeing the umpire, even through his mask, I can see him wince. And so I'm running out there with these baseballs, and I realize what happened. But again, I'm delirious. So I'm just like running up to him, and I'm just thinking, wow, I almost got hit in the head with that bat. And the umpire says, son, you got to be careful near the on-deck circle. And I'm like, okay. And I just go running, back, and, I stand clear of Corey Snyder on my way back. But that is my connection to Corey Snyder, who at last check is managing over in Asia. Yes, after managing in the Mexican League, he's been managing the China Trust Brothers of the Chinese Professional Baseball League. So there you go. Corey Snyder, not just a good rated rookie for the 1986 Donruss pack here, but also nearly taking my head off. And thank God I didn't get hit by that hump, by that bat in the helmet, because there was that really tragic story of that 8-year-old boy who died in Kansas City a few years ago with the Kansas City T-bones. And that just, that reminded me of the Corey Snyder story. But, you know, I've got a young child as well. And, you know, just, I mean, seeing the pictures of that incident were just heart-wrenching. But, you know, I can kind of look back at, you know, the Corey Snyder incident, and it's all part of that bigger story of that day, which was an absolute debacle, but one of my favorite memories, which, again, I'll share on Wax and Gum Stains. So if you have that chance to get the 86 Tops or the 86 Donruss or the 86 Fleer cards, go ahead and do it. You've got some great cards in that set, and you can really get them at a good price. Like I mentioned, they're kind of at that cutoff point where once you get to 85 and back into the early 80s, you know, the prices start going up a little bit. And then once you get into the 70s, they go way up. So you can get some pretty good cards and some pretty nice sets for a pretty affordable price. Well, that'll wrap it up. We did lots of talking here, lots to discuss with the cards we found, the sets that we pulled from, the packs that we pulled from, and also some great commentary about manager cards, about the Baines and Rains Hall of Fame talk, and also the SSPC set from 1975. Remember, our next show is 2 weeks from this Friday, so that will be January 11th. We'll see what we pull out and talk about for that particular show, but I do hope that you can join us on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry, Spotify, or Google Play, or however you listen to Wax Ecstatic. Again, spread the word about Wax Ecstatic to all your collecting friends, and if you have a couple extra dollars left over from your Christmas shopping and want to support Wax Ecstatic, you can do so at Wax Ecstatic on PayPal. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. We appreciate all your donations and support, and we certainly appreciate you listening. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. This is Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.